You are listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
The Paranormal News Insider from ParanewsInsider.com. Produced by WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of November 8th, 2016, and episode number 288. And this is your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. Yes, November 8th, it's election night. I said election night. And we got a special night for you ahead of you tonight. The Paranormal News Insider, of course, this is what you're listening to right now from 7 o'clock Eastern to 8 o'clock Eastern. I don't know, if you live somewhere else, you're in trouble, because I'm not doing that the whole time conversion thing for you guys. Just kidding. Be sure to keep listening after this show tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern. I guess that's what, 7 p.m. Central for you guys. Frank Lee is going to be here covering the election night. He's going to be wearing a suit and tie, all spruced up with his little news anchor gear on. Frank and his co-host Donald Davis will have live coverage of the 2016 presidential election results. Going to have some call-ins, and I'll tell you what, some much-needed tension breakers tonight. You're going to need that. I'm telling you, it's nerve-wracking. So tonight, Paranormalities and Ponderings radio show with host Frank Lee and co-host Donald Davis are going to be talking live election updates all night long. I don't know. I don't think I can watch TV. I'd rather listen to that and have some tension breakers and have some fun and a little relaxation instead of all the typical stuff you're going to be hearing on your local news. Who wants to hear that? But before all that fun stuff, tonight, the Paranormal News, we're going to talk about a review of the third Ghost Excavation Conference that I attended over the weekend. I had a little bit of trouble. Didn't get to participate in everything I wanted to. Made it out there okay, but getting home, completely different story. We're also going to talk about misappropriation of public funds. Well, that's cryptozoology for you. Wait, what? That's right. Misappropriation of public funds and cryptozoology. And Bigfoot, yes, Bigfoot has been sold on eBay. That's an interesting story. We also had the Phoenix Lights Part 3 and Lies and Scandals in Politics. Well, that might not be true. That's another wait what moment right there, but we'll find out about that story coming up tonight here on the Paranormal News Insider. And tonight's episode is brought to you in part by the Thomas Francis University. Thomas Francis University is a metaphysics school that offers online spiritually based bachelor's, master's, and PhD doctoral metaphysical degrees, as well as single standalone courses in related metaphysical and esoteric topics. Instructors are easily accessible and offer world-class customer service and instruction. TFU and other ICMH schools have hundreds of students and graduates in more than 50 countries worldwide. For more information on Thomas Francis University, please visit tfuniversity.org. You can learn something. No, I did. This weekend, I guess we'll just talk about the third Ghost Excavation Conference and what happened? Well, it's quite exciting. It was very interesting. Some of the topics and things that were covered kind of got out there a little late. Events were supposed to kick off on 6 p.m. on Friday, November 4th. And they're going to have a little meet and greet dinner. I had to work till 2 o'clock. It was up since 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever. And I was a little tired getting into town. So, I just kind of took a nap and I didn't end up going all the way up, but I was there. I was in the area. I just kind of missed it. I didn't get into town until well after 7:30, close to 8 o'clock, I think. And so I decided just to skip the night festivities. I'd already missed the meet and greet dinner, so I didn't figure there was anything wrong with that. Just taking a nap, getting rested up for Saturday, which is the beginning of this whole thing at the Omni Bedford Springs Resort and Spa in Bedford, which is a historical location in Bedford, Pennsylvania, kind of the south area there of Pennsylvania. It's pretty close to Maryland and Washington, D.C. There was a lot of Washington, D.C. memorabilia there, which is kind of weird, but okay. It was pretty close, a couple hours away from D.C. And this event lasted all weekend, the 4th, like I mentioned, on Friday. It lasted Saturday and Sunday. And I spoke on Sunday morning. And yeah, like I said, I was a little late Friday, but was there somewhat on time on Saturday morning. Just having a hard time sleeping. I don't know what it is. I think it's because of the staying up late for all these Indians games, all the playoff games throughout November, October, November, just kind of messed up my sleep schedule. But I was up out there, and Mary Becker kicked off the festivities. She was one of the hosts of the event. And John followed that up with the excavation of contemporary ghost haunting, where he talked lots of great points about the current status of the paranormal field, from its reliance upon tools to the concept of paranormal unity. It's really good the way he put everything into context and just tied it all together, just kind of launched this conference, which was about doing things against the status quo. What can we do in the paranormal field that can stir up a different way to do things, a different approach, and different mentalities towards the whole ghost investigation methodology that we see on television and we see, covered, on YouTube and on Facebook and all this stuff. It's tiring to see the same stuff over and over again. And we're not going in any good direction. We're just kind of spinning in circles. We're repeating the same things over and over again. And we really, in my opinion, haven't really left the spiritualism era of the mid-1800s. And I don't know. I think it's just time for new directions. And that was what this whole thing was about. And after John's a pretty intense speaker. If you've ever had the opportunity to listen to John Sable speak, he can be pretty intense. He's very passionate about what he does, the ghost excavation methodology, and very passionate about this field, very entrenched in what he does. As a researcher, as an investigator, awesome researcher. His library is probably bigger than half the libraries here in Ohio. In his office, he's got books all over his house, memorabilia from the movies that he's been in. He's also an actor, archaeologist, among other things, and was also a professor. So he just has that way of when he's talking. Very passionate, pounding the desk, yelling and screaming. He yelled a couple of times and got the attention of everybody, but he was actually subdued at this event. He was kind of like laid back, which is kind of weird to see, but he still got his point across. And after that was Brandon Masullo, who talked about the ingredients for a ghostly experience, which was I kind of already had a preview for that. I already knew what he was talking about, but he did a very good job of explaining his kind of view of how a ghostly experience is actually created through his background as a licensed counselor in the state of Ohio and working at the Koestler Parapsychology Unit in Scotland. So he's got a pretty good background dealing with people and then a very solid understanding of parapsychology. So tying all that stuff together, and looking at the human experience, which is important, it's really missing out there. You know, it seems like people are consumed with ghosts, and they don't care about the living person. So Brandon looks at the living experience. How do we have these experiences? And it includes three very simple pieces that are in his ingredients, not eggs, flour, and milk, but it's pretty darn close. They're largely overlooked, and they tie it together to potentially create a paranormal experience. And he's working on a book. He's working on getting a book published. It's always a fun journey to get a book on the bookshelves, I can tell you. Yeah, not really. But he's working on a book for this method that he's talking. Well, not really a method, but a kind of a hypothesis about ghostly experiences, which I think is very important. And I hope a lot of people pay attention to this because I think it's going to really open a lot of eyes and hopefully help people look at the living person, the living experience about all these things. And when he gets his book out, I'm surely going to pass that information on. And more than likely, I would say definitely, is going to be the book of the week whenever he can get everything put together and get it out here for us. Then Kelly Weaver, she was next. She was talking about connecting with the spirit world, a medium's perspective. A little bit kind of off topic a little bit, I guess. But Kelly, very experienced investigator and researcher, and shared her kind of viewpoint on being a medium. It's hard for us, those of us that don't have any psychic abilities, to really resonate with people like that. So it's nice when people can explain what they're dealing with and what they're seeing and what they're interpreting from their viewpoint and can share it with people in a very, very meaningful way where it's explained. And it's not just said that this is what's really happening because I'm experiencing it kind of thing that sometimes you get with some mediums and psychics, which are different things. But she did a good job of really putting things into a unique perspective for us to digest. The next up was John Weaver. Yeah, they're related, husband and wife. And John spoke on seeking the paranormal, highlighting a quarter century of research and investigation. Yes, 25 years as a researcher and investigator. I don't know. I got 5 more years to go. Not that I'm bragging, but that's a long time, a quarter of a century to be dabbling in the paranormal field. So he brought a little bit to the table on his viewpoints of investigating here in the 21st century. And then we had Robert Brad Bradley. Robert kind of went in a really weird direction, different direction. Didn't see this one coming. I saw it on the list talking about GOES system magnetometer data. And his thing here was called a proposed correlation between the perception of paranormal manifestations and GOES system magnetometer data. And I had an idea that he was talking about the geostationary satellite systems, but I wasn't sure. I wasn't 100% sure until we got there. And I had to ask him before because I was wondering. And he said, yes, it's about the geostationary operational environmental satellite. You may wonder what that is. Well, GOES is a set of satellites that help monitor the weather here on Earth. If you've ever seen any kind of satellite data that shows pretty much the whole United States, that's the GOES satellite system. Helps us get pretty much all the weather from all the channels. Anybody that's dealing with weather gets some of their information, if not all of their information, from these satellite systems. And also the space weather. So anybody that has one of those space weather little thingy-majiggies on their website in the GOES field, they're getting their information from the GOES satellite system, geostationary operational environmental satellites. And those are hanging out up in the magnetosphere, which is just over 22,000 miles above the Earth. That's pretty high. And again, that's where we get all of our weather data, weather information. And they also the space weather, use of magnetometers. So with the weather instruments, they have an X-ray sensor, a proton and alpha wave detectors. There is also a magnetometer. And a magnetometer is the readings that Robert is concentrating his work on with gathering cases of perceived paranormal experiences that are notated with time and location to see where they lie with data collected from the GOES satellite. Now, he feels there's a correlation that could lead to more understanding of paranormal experiences. And he's already basically plotting the information he's gathered, and he's trying to get other people to submit data as well so he can continue to plot data on these GOES satellite readings when pretty much in real time when the GOES satellite is giving data and he plots the data from the exact time and locations He can correlate that with readings collected by the GOES satellite. Now, it's finite changes in data, but looking for any kind of correlation we can, of any kind of explanation we can find for how things are changing environmentally, could help tie things together paranormally. So already we've had Brandon Masullo talking about the human experience, and now Robert Bradley talking about environmental connections. I was really excited to see that already on day one of this conference. Two very differentiating points, looking at it at a scientific angle through the environment and through the living person. That's what we're here about. This isn't all about, does the obelisk work? Can we really get good EVP by doing certain things? No, this is some good stuff here. This is some good science that we're dealing with here. And that was it for Saturday night. We all went out. We had dinner. And we planned on coming back at around 11 o'clock for a ghost excavation of the Omni Bedford Springs Hotel. Very old place. I think it was, can't remember the date, 1796, something like that. Very old. Had one of the first indoor pools in the United States as well. And James Buchanan, who was president at the time, around when this building was in its beginnings of its heyday, I hung out here quite a bit, over 20 years, and that's actually the room where we were having our conference in was the Buchanan room, where he actually spent a lot of his time, which is kind of cool, kind of weird. I mean, maybe not the greatest president ever. You know, well, it's kind of hard to say which one was better than the other. We always look at him as who was worse than the next, but nonetheless, a little historical thing there, and it's interesting to talk about now, and it was right before the election, so that's kind of weird that we were dealing with presidential stuff at that time. So we were supposed to meet back up. We had dinner, and right after dinner, I had to go back and get my car and go back and change into a little snazzy little suit, and I had some hats that were era-specific for that time frame. Had a lot of other little things I was going to contribute to the ghost excavation that night, but on the way back through Bedford, headed for myself to head out of town, head westward a little bit, about 15 miles away. I didn't get pretty much about a mile and a half outside of the Omni Bedford Springs Hotel when my car decided to go deer hunting. And I collected my first buck of the season, and my airbag deployed. I had to pull over to the side of the road, and my car was pretty much undrivable. After smacking a big buck, didn't see it coming. It just kind of came out of nowhere. It was kind of rattling and kind of ruined my night in more ways than one. I was a little shaken up, and luckily I was able to flag down John and Mary, and they stopped and were able to help me through that situation, which is very appreciative. I don't think they would have just said, you know, screw you, we'll see you later. But, I mean, obviously, being human beings, I think they would go out of their way to help me out. So they did, and went back to their house and babysat their dog for the night, and started dealing with all the phone calls and trying to figure out how I was going to get home the following day and how I'm going to get my car taken care of and all that fun political stuff that you have to deal with when you have a car accident, and just went to bed. So I didn't get to partake in the ghost excavation that night. I guess so. They had some issues with that as well. John and Mary do a ghost tour at the Omni Bedford Springs Hotel every night, well, a couple times a night, and they had another one that lasted a little longer than they expected, and so it kind of dragged on, and they didn't start. They initially said 11 o'clock, then it was, let's shoot for 11:15, we'll meet up, and that ended up being midnight, and by the time they started getting everything together, it's ghost excavation is kind of a process. So they had to go through the process and go through specific things that they were going to do during the ghost excavation. And so they didn't really start until about 1 o'clock, but they did have some interesting things happen. Somebody saw an apparition in the pool area and some other little details and things that were not really verifiable, unfortunately, but it was still a good experience for those that were there, and those people got to learn different things, and I missed out on it. was kind of mad about that. But, you know, I had to deal with what I had to deal with and kind of wasn't feeling like going back out after my experience with the book. And so I went to sleep. And the next morning, I was actually the first to speak at 10 o'clock in the morning. I really wasn't into it all that much. I tried, but my mind was elsewhere. So I don't think I gave a great performance. I did what I could. But like I said, heart wasn't in it. My back hurt. My shoulders hurt. Really wasn't feeling all that great that morning. But I did talk about the E4 method. And my presentation was titled Altering the Culture of Paranormal Investigation. And I'll talk a little bit more about the E4 method and kind of what my presentation entailed. Because guess what? The E4 method is the book of the week this week. Wow. How do they plan that out? Well, it just kind of happened, I guess. So I'll talk a little bit more about the E4 method after we do the news, which is coming up. Hold on. Sit tight. We're almost done with this. So after my presentation was Patty Wilson. Patty Wilson is a pretty famous, pretty popular local researcher and investigator. She's been around for quite a long time, at least 20 years or so. Been a part of numerous books in Pennsylvania and I believe Virginia too, in that whole neck of the woods. As a researcher, investigator, and documentarian on all things paranormal. And she had a lot of stories, and she had a lot of interesting, unique stories about the area, mainly in Bedford, Pennsylvania, where she resides. And she had a very moving story. I wish I could tell it the way she told it. It might not even have been the story that was emotional, but just the way she told it. She's an expert storyteller. She just knows how to get the whole crowd as a whole entire unit on board, and she just drags you along, and at the right time, she just hits you with information, and it just makes your eyes want to well up and shed some tears. And it was just beautiful the way she tied it all together. But it was a story of how a ghost story got her involved in helping a Confederate soldier get a proper burial in Texas after having an unmarked grave in Pennsylvania. And it sounds simple, but if you heard the story, it was hard to hold back those tears. I don't know, maybe I was just overly emotional, but a lot of other people had commented that it was a beautiful story. And the way she tied it together was very good. She did an excellent job there in getting our emotions involved. And then after her was Jonathan Williams. Got an extensive background in law enforcement and forensics, and he spoke on a very unique method. Again, another environmental kind of look at the ghost field, which I think a lot more people are leaning into, other than the kind of the human aspect. And he talked on paraforensics. It's a term he came up with. I've heard other people use forensics in regards to the paranormal, but I'm pretty sure he's the one that first used this at least 6-7 years ago, if not longer. And his presentation was titled Paraforensics: Exhuming the Crime Scene to Find Residual and Intelligent Witnesses, which essentially uses forensic methodologies in the ghost investigation field. And it's actually defined as the paranormal forensic study of crime scene residuals and missing person detection through a supernatural methodology. So kind of an example here, if there's a missing persons case, whether it's a warm case, which is an ongoing case, or a cold case, which is one that's been going on for quite a while. Obviously, if you know anything about, you watch any crime detectives shows or read any books, you know that a kidnapping, you pretty much have a very small window before there's bad news usually to find this person. So what he would do is, on a missing persons, he would go to this location and essentially try to connect with ghosts or any kind of residual energy that's at that location to see if any kind of things would turn up that would provide any kind of forensic data. And in the case of cold cases or anything like that, it would be the same thing, because it doesn't take a dead person to get information from ghosts. People can be living and imprint data into the environment. So it's possible that we could extract information that's imprinted from the environment, from living people, and get a little bit of that information. it's really an interesting process. And he does have a book called Paraforensics, and you can find that on Amazon. It's written by, again, Jonathan Williams. And in my normal fashion, I did collect three books this weekend, one of which is Jonathan Williams, Paraforensics, and hopefully be able to read through those the next few weeks and get a couple of them, if not all three of them, as the books of the week here on the Paranormal News Insider, which I do each and every week, give you the book of the week. And that's your report there on the third Ghost Excavation Conference. Now, Monday, somehow I made it home Sunday. Actually, Brandon Masullo very graciously had to put up with me for 209 miles, took me home, and kicked me into the curb. No, he was fantastic. I mean, he gave me a ride home, which is kind of freaking out. I didn't know how I'd get home. Don't ever get in an accident on a Saturday night. All of the rental car agencies pretty much overwhelmingly are closed on Sundays, so I had no way to get home. But Brandon gave me a lift and brought me home, so I appreciate that very much. And so Monday, I was sitting there waiting to pick up a rental car, and looks like at least 10 days I'm going to be driving this GMC Acadia around, this big, I call it an ice box on wheels. I was sitting there going through Facebook, and I saw that I was tagged in a Facebook post by a friend of mine, Colin Schneider, who is a 16-year-old cryptozoologist. And he's an awesome researcher. He's actually already well-known by a lot of people, from Lauren Coleman to Lyle Blackburn. I mean, pretty much any name you name in the cryptid field, they already are fully aware of what Colin brings to the table. So I get this notification, and he was sharing the fact that he had an article in the latest edition of Cryptid Culture magazine. And he was shocked to find out that, I was as well. I had an article in there. And I kind of forgot about it, dealing with everything that was going on the weekend. I didn't realize it was coming out already. I thought it was not toward the end of November, but it was a good surprise. Now, my feature, the article, is The Rise and Fall of the Loveland Frog. And it kind of takes into part, if you've been listening to the show for the last few weeks, I did talk about a new story about the Loveland Frog and kind of how the story is kind of wound around toward the end there. And so I kind of cover the history of the Loveland Frog in a nice little article. It's not overly long, but I get to the point. It's a pretty good, I think it's pretty good because I wrote it. Nice little story there. And Colin talked about a variety of stories surrounding the Chupacabra, which is also a very interesting topic. And others featured in this magazine. Now, this is the fourth magazine that they've done. So this is the fourth edition, which is, I want to say it's monthly, maybe bi-monthly, I don't know. Hopefully I'll contribute a little bit more to this magazine as time moves forward. It was really good. The people that were behind this Cryptid Culture magazine were very, very nice and very knowledgeable about the whole process of dealing with writing a magazine and putting it together. And I think it's a really nice magazine. And I've ordered a hard copy, and you can too if you're interested. Others featured in the magazine, Lyle Blackburn, Lauren Coleman, again, myself, Colin Schneider, and a couple of other people. And they have some fantastic artwork in this too if you're into paranormal. Well, I guess it's cryptozoological-based artwork. It's beautiful in this magazine. Now, you can read part of the magazine online, but it's only part of it. You can read a majority of what I wrote, but you can't read it all. You can't read it all, but you can purchase your very own hardcover version. And let me get this link, put it in the chat room. It's not that expensive. It's not that expensive. Yeah, but I've already shared the link, I believe, on the Paranormal News Insider Facebook page. I'll throw that link in the chat room, but I'll probably share it again because it was pretty fun. It was nice to write that. I think it was a pretty good piece the way I kind of put it together. And Colin's article is very good as well. So it's a great magazine. And I've read through a couple of them already from the previous three editions. And it's a pretty professional magazine and big name people in that. And it was good that I could throw my name in there as well. And a couple of other quick things here before our little break. The paranormal poll. Yeah, I forgot about it. I kind of forgot about it too. I get it. I've asked another question on there, so I think I'm up to like three questions. I'm going to try to add one every other week, regardless if people are getting involved or not. I think it's a nice little thing to kind of stretch the imagination and to get people talking about different things. And this question is, are tools absolutely necessary for ghost investigations? And tools, by tools, I mean the obelisk, the paranormal puck, the ghost box, EMF detector, so on and so forth. Are those absolutely necessary for ghost investigations? So I don't have the responses in front of me, but I think there's like four responses. And you can leave a comment as well on that site. And so you can vote and leave a comment as well. And we'll discuss that as it unfolds. And last but not least, the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure. I mentioned this last week. The tickets went on sale September 19th. And 2 weeks ago now, last Thursday before last, Benner's Meadow Run Cabins released their 2017 schedule and are now taking reservations for the event weekend. And that is May 5th through the 7th, 2017 in Farmington, Pennsylvania. I'm going to be driving a tank so I don't hit any deer. Steve Cole, Stan Gordon, myself are returning speakers. J. Bechochin and host Eric Altman and a few others have been added to the list. Again, the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure, it will be intense. And intense. We're going to be intense, and it's going to be intense. Yeah, if you didn't get it last week, you probably won't get it this week. That's okay. So just want to let you know you're tuned into WCJV Digital Broadcasting from Youngstown, New York, emanating live at WCJVradio.com. And you're listening to the Paranormal News Insider with your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. And in about a half hour, stay tuned if you're listening live. Frank Lee is coming on to cover the election night live. Frank and his co-host, Donald Davis, will have live coverage of the 2016 presidential election results. Don't watch your local news channel. I know you want to find out the local stuff. I get it. But come on. It's just so boring. Gonna have some live call-ins and a lot of tension breakers tonight. It's a welcome relief. I mean, come on, I can't wait till these stupid commercials are over. Yeah, so stay tuned for Paranormalities and Ponderings with host Frank Lee and his co-host Donald Davis as they tackle the presidential election results live here on WCJV Radio. WCJVradio.com. So we're going to jump into the news here. Already lost my spot. Well, cryptid news. Why not? Cryptid news. Yeah, not a not so good story this week leading off cryptid news. I would have to say probably the most viral story in cryptozoology this week, at least within the mainstream media. And it was weird to see this story covered by as many outlets as this story was covered. Got a little scary because it's not a favorable story for this field whatsoever. Back in February of this year, the University of New Mexico's Gallup campus held a Bigfoot conference titled Bigfoot in New Mexico, Evidence, Ecology, and Behavior. Well, the event was coordinated by the leader of the Gallup campus, New Mexico, Dr. Christopher Dyer. Dyer is a believer in Bigfoot and claims to have had his own encounter. So he basically runs this. It's a campus, so it's not the main campus. It's just kind of like an offset little campus off to the side there. And it's kind of in Native American country. Now, the event was viewed as a success since it overflowed the original area it was initially set to be in, and ended up being held in the main auditorium. Now, the event featured Dr. Jeff Meldrum, and a local naturalist, and was hailed as a success by Dyer, who said, quote, "It was the largest and most well-attended event in the history of this campus," unquote. Well, That was the story. That was it. Until a few days ago, when an investigation pointed out that Dyer used public funding to put on the two-day event, which also included an expedition. Not a Ford expedition, but an actual expedition out into the environment with some of the participants of the conference, the convention there, going out in the woods, up in the mountains, up in the snow, on the public's money. How much money? Well, $7,458. That's a lot of cash. That was spent on advertising. Now, a $1,000 honorarium plus expenses was handed off to Dr. Jeff Meldrum, and a $500 honorarium plus expenses to New Mexico naturalist Rob Kreider. And if that wasn't enough, Dyer also spent taxpayer money on the expedition that spent money on hotels in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, food, expenses, plus seven pairs of snowshoes for $140. I don't know what they're crying about that. 20 bucks, that's not bad for a little pair of snowshoes. I think what they mean is like those little things that you slip over your boots. You get those at Walmart. 20 bucks, that's pretty much the going price. I don't know why they're crying, 140 bucks. Anyway, now, there was no faculty or students on the expedition except for Dyer, who even admitted it was a fruitless expedition. He said, quote, "If I had to say, it was pretty much a blown waste of money because we did not find evidence because of the snow. It was just impossible to get around out there. So in that case, yeah, we spent money on that again. Absolutely not," unquote. Huh. So well, I guess the snow did it. You had seven pairs of snowshoes. Dave Thomas. No, not that Dave Thomas. Dave Thomas, a lecturer and tech instructor, added, quote, "I think the odds against would be a billions to one. It makes much sense for the UNM to have a Bigfoot hunt in the Sanditas as it would be for UNM to host a field trip to find a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow," unquote. Well, how do you really feel? Robert Frank, the University of New Mexico president, put it simply, quote, "Dr. Dyer needs to be much more thoughtful about how he undertakes these activities. The type of expedition that we just took place was not appropriate and will not occur in that manner again," unquote. So I guess the lesson of the story is don't use the public's money to fund your Bigfoot event or an expedition. I think if they didn't do the expedition, I think this might have flown under the radar. You're still talking about at least $1,500 and the usage of the Well, it doesn't sound like they have that much going on. If a Bigfoot investigation or a Bigfoot conference is the biggest and most well-attended event in history, I think they need to look at their science program a little closer there. But I think it's nice to hear that they got people together. And it's the what's regarded as the first publicly funded Bigfoot expedition in history. And they got nothing. They got nothing. The skeptics were pretty upset about this. And there was a lot of skeptical people that commented on this story and weighed in on it. And yeah, well, it took them a while to figure it out, but that's kind of embarrassing, the use of misappropriation of public funding for that event. So speaking of the name Dyer, if that sounds familiar, there's a guy named Rick Dyer. We're not going to talk about him. But he's actually in the news, but no, he wasn't out hoaxing. He's a well-known hoaxer, known for that Georgia Bigfoot hoax back in 2008. But he wasn't out hoaxing last week, at least that I know of. And I really can't speak much for this week. But Travis Driver recently sold his one-of-a-kind Bigfoot suit on eBay. The suit was used in the 2015 small-budget indie movie titled Something in the Woods, which was a flashback to an event that is inspired by true events that took place in the 1960s. I'm watching the preview of this movie. I really want to see this. It looks really good. The suit is very realistic and was completely handmade. The suit has built-in muscle with flexibility and is covered in high-grade National Fiber Technology fur and includes latex hands, feet, and a very detailed mask. And the entire thing took over 300 man hours to create. Now, the suit was listed on eBay. The initial was like $2,500, and it actually sold for $2,500. I'm not sure why. I guess he didn't really hold out. Maybe he had a suitor in mind. I don't know. But it sold on Halloween for $2,500, and a lot of people were worried. A lot of people commented that they were worried that the suit would get in the hands of someone who wanted to, you know, create a hoax, run around in traffic, or you know, run across the road and hopefully not get shot or hit by a car. Thank goodness maybe I won't hit him, because that would be pretty bad. Travis commented on that that worry by some of the people, and he said, quote, "I promise I will not sell to Rick Dyer," unquote. But we so far, we don't know who bought it, and we don't know. It really makes you wonder who bought it and what they intend to use this one-of-a-kind suit for. Well, I guess it's only time will tell. We might have to wait till next Halloween. I don't know. Let me get that link, throw it in the chat room. If you're missing out in the chat room, you're missing out on live links. You're missing out on the crowd of people in the chat room here. And it looks like Paul made it after all. Good evening, Paul. Good to see you. And we also have Jim Mallard from the Mallard Report is live in the chat room as well. Good to see him in the chat room. Good friend, fellow radio host out there. We're going to jump to UFO news and the Phoenix Lights. Sounds familiar, right? You probably heard of the Phoenix Lights. Well, that took place back on March 13th, 1997. That was a long time ago. And it was one of the most mass-viewed UFO events in U.S. history and was witnessed by thousands. Thousands of people claimed to witness this event as it unfolded for over 3 hours that night. And, despite that, the explanation was blanketed as a military training exercise over a small location just outside of Phoenix, despite sightings happening all over, beginning from Prescott, which is about 79 aeronautical miles away from Phoenix. And what people saw was not lights in the sky. It was actually the absence of lights and a very large V-shaped craft that was blocking out the stars, blocking out the sky. And lots of people reported that, but the military didn't have an explanation for that. They just wiped it away, and they made fun of it in the media. It was probably the biggest UFO story since 1947. Well, the lights returned again in 2007 and 2008, although military flares were used to explain the 2007 event again. And the 2008 one was weird. It was a strange admission of a guy who was tying flares to a helium balloon by a guy in Phoenix. And we never heard anything what came about that. That should be something you get in trouble for. You go to jail for something. And the guy admitted it, and seemingly nothing ever happened to him. I don't know. Kind of weird. October 25th of this year, well, it seems like the lights are back. Twitter was on fire with reports of UFOs from Tucson to Phoenix. That's a pretty large area. It's like 300 square miles of area that these sightings took place in. A Luke Air Force Base stated that all the flights had been grounded earlier that evening at the Air Force Base. So that would have not have been an explanation for the sightings. That's weird for them to admit that they weren't a part of that. No flares this year. But you wonder, are the folks in Arizona just trigger happy about UFOs, or is this area becoming a hotspot for visitations? And so far, I haven't heard any more about UFO sightings in the area, but we'll keep our eyes and ears peeled to see, because I'm telling you what, that was a huge story. Like I said, probably the largest UFO story since Roswell. And we had the Jerusalem UFO events a few years later. That really paled in comparison how long the Phoenix Lights were in the media, in the news, and how far-reaching that story was. So we'll keep an eye. Well, we'll keep at least one eye, maybe one ear open to that. Now, other news. Again, tonight, don't forget to keep listening right after this show, about 15, 16, 17 minutes from now, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central for live election night coverage. I'm just having a withdrawal. I need to find out who's leading right now. my goodness, I can't believe this. I've gone 45 minutes without looking at the results, the live results, but you can find out live election results as they happen tonight during Paranormalities and Ponderings with host Frank Lee and his co-host, Donald Davis. Now, certainly a lot of pondering coming up during and after Tuesday night for sure about the future of this country. But, well, in honor of this, not to get on my soapbox, in honor of this, I have a story that ties into election night, believe it or not, and the paranormal. Yeah. It comes from the Denver Post. And just to kind of like preface this, I've done my best. If you follow me on Facebook at all, you listen to the show, I try my best to keep my political feelings out of social media. And I've watched how mud has been slung in each direction. People have unfriended each other and gotten mad over comments, which is really silly. I mean, it's just opinions, even though everybody thinks their opinions are right. And, you know, hurt feelings. It's just weird. This election year is just, people have just been really fired up about this. And with the mud being slung in each direction, a lot of it rightly so, I get it. But every now and again, something like this next story has cropped up, which people, you know, they've been brought into this and they let it, allow it, I should say, to dictate their emotions and feelings towards certain candidates. Now, I'm not sticking up for either candidate here. I'm just looking at the story and it's disturbing that stories like this are popping up everywhere and people are buying into them with little or no research into these stories, and they're just really buying into them. And even when they're pointed out to be what they are, people still will fight tooth and nail about it. But the article I'm talking about here is written by Eric Lubbers of the Denver Post, and it's simply titled, quote, "There is no such thing as a Denver Guardian, despite that Facebook post you saw," unquote. I don't know if that's really a great title for that. I don't know how good journalism that is. But anyway, "There's no such thing as the Denver Guardian, despite that Facebook post you saw." And it obviously covers a social media story circulating about Hillary Clinton that is false on many levels. The article talks about a story with the headline, "FBI agent suspected in Hillary email leaks found dead in apparent murder-suicide," along with a photograph of a fire. Again, I don't care who the story was, you know, was about Trump or Hillary Clinton. I'm not defending either one of them. Or throwing either one of them under the bus. I think they've done a pretty good job of that each other for this election and maybe the next election. But it's just the story. And the story started circulating on November 5th and at one point was creating 100 shares per minute. 100 shares per minute. That is disturbing. Now, the biggest problem is that the article appears in the Denver Guardian, which states that, quote, "Denver Guardian is Denver's oldest news source and one of the longest-running daily newspapers published in the United States. With a focus on local content, The Guardian thrives to maintain a nonpartisan newsroom, making our content the most reliable source available in print and across the web," unquote. Well, the real problem is the Denver Guardian doesn't exist. It's not real. Nope, never been real. A list of other red flags listed by Lubbers in his Post article includes the fact that the URL for the Denver Guardian was created in July of this year. Well, so much for the oldest news source and longest running daily newspapers. Yeah. And it's hosted through GoDaddy. GoDaddy, you know, the owner that goes and kills exotic animals for fun. The article is apparently the only one working on the site, and others state that there are server issues with the site itself. Clever, clever. Well, the physical address to the newsroom turns out to be a tree in a parking lot. I guess that says enough about their editorial. Anyway, even the city of Walkerville, Maryland, which is mentioned in the story, does not exist. And while there is a Walkersville, they don't have a police station, let alone a police chief named Pat Frederick, as named in the article. And the image of the fire, these are usually the first thing I go after, is if there's images used in a story and stated that they're actually for the story, I go right after them. I look them up right away. It's the first thing I do to verify any story. And then I look at the details, of course. The image of the fire was taken from a Flickr account of a house fire that happened in 2010, And you really don't have to go much further than that to realize that the story is a complete sham. But people bought into it. They believed it. And I mention this story since there have been a number of such stories that have been passed around this political season about, again, both candidates. And it's just disturbing because people will believe this stuff. It's perpetrated by a potential news organization. And maybe on the flip side, it's good that we're challenging the media. You know, are they true? Are they fake? I mean, people have been criticizing Fox News and other news outlets for years. And now here's these fake news sites coming in here, coming into play as well. But we're also familiar with all of this happening in the paranormal. But again, this year it's been unprecedented with the sheer number of falsified articles hitting the internet and social media this year surrounding this election. And with all this misinformation, the truth is still hard to believe, but hopefully it will not have an effect on anyone's decisions to vote tonight for the lesser of two evils. And it's disturbing too. I really can't get into the entire story, but if you read through that article, it's disturbing because there's people in other countries that are basically getting paid to create these kinds of sites to fool the American public. It's weird. It's just scary that this is all going on out there. But it is what it is, and we have to deal with that and do our best to provide proper information. And that's what I like to do here on the Paranormal News Insider, give you the reality behind these stories, whether it's paranormal or it's just something it's in the news and it's viral. I like to clear things up. I do my research. And I give you the information that you need to be, awakened for. And speaking of being awakened, the book of the week. I don't really have a whole lot of time to really discuss this in full detail. And I couldn't even do it in 45 minutes over the weekend at the Third Ghost Excavation Conference. The book of the week this week is The E4 Method, Breaking the Mold of Paranormal Investigation. And by mold, I don't mean like, mold like bathroom sink kind of mold or anything like that, but just mold. And Dita's thrown the Amazon link in there, but I'm going to throw my link through lulu.com. You pay a little bit more money. That link there will give you all the books that I've written. And I'm pretty sure that the E4 method is only available in paperback now that I'm looking at it. So I was hoping it was in the ebook version, but it's not. But you could check out all the books there. And it's not that expensive, $10. Who doesn't have $10 lying around to learn a new methodology? And I didn't have a cover shot readily available. So I appreciate that, Dita. Thank you very much. You're off the hook tonight. And off the hook, meaning that you're not in trouble. The E4 Method, Breaking the Mold of Paranormal Investigation. This book I wrote in basically reaction to the fact that I inadvertently came up with a new methodology of client-based investigation procedures. I shut down my group, in 2011 after some kind of personal reflection at the time about the direction of the field or the group itself. After 15 years as active researchers, I kind of decided we weren't going in the direction that I wanted to go. And there's some internal conflict, internal problems, just decided to pull the plug. And it was hard to do because, that was my baby. That was something that I've nurtured throughout the years and have built and rebuilt and have taken care of and tried to provide a good impression to the public for and public relations kind of stuff. And it was hard to do, but I had to do it because it was healthy for myself and for the potential of the group if I was ever to rebuild it again. And I spent that fall and early spring of 2012 contemplating what went wrong. What did I do wrong? What could I do better if I'm going to get back into this field full time as a investigator and a leader of a group? I need to do something different. I realized that I kind of veered off in the way I used to do interviews, and I veered off in the way I did investigations and kind of did things the status quo and became a little bit too subjective. I allowed my assumptions to get in the way and became a little bit more reliant on tool usage I've got a guy in the group that just had a lot of tools and technology, and it kind of overruled the group in our direction. It wasn't something I really wanted to happen, but it happened because a group is a group, and it's made of individuals within that group. And it was really hard to walk away from that at the time, but I had to do it. And again, it kind of came up with an idea of different things. I was reading a lot of books at the time. Scientific Paranormal Investigation by Benjamin Radford is a skeptical look at ghost investigation. And it gave me a lot of good ideas as to what to avoid or how to fix certain parts of the paranormal. Because they did a good job, I should say Benjamin Radford did a good job of pointing out a lot of things we're doing wrong. But he really never said how to do things. So I kind of took that as a personal challenge to put together kind of a methodology. Wasn't expecting it to have a name or to be something I would write a book for, just maybe minor changes. But I realized the more I put this thing together, the more it would take some major changes and look at some of the opportunities that there were really, I mean, it really affected the field. You know, subjective experiences, subjective investigation methods, belief and assumption-based investigations, the complete reliance pretty much on unproven tools and technology or tools that are used incorrectly, and the scientific process really not being understood by people. I wanted to create something that was a process and something that would be open to peer review, and that's really the basis for creating the E4 method. And it allows for a little bit more objective look, but also a little bit of subjectiveness, which is necessary, and you can't really be completely objective in a field research investigation. But kind of to put it quickly, I use this real simple ghost math formula. Client plus environment equals ghost. Yeah, I know that's simplified. It's really overly simplistic. But just think about it. A client, we understand the event that happened to them. We understand how they feel about what happened to them. We understand their emotions, and we can kind of guide them through the process of what they're dealing with. And we can try to empower them through this process so that they can move on from this event. So the client, okay, we can deal with them. Now the environment, we can't control the environment per se, but we can understand the environment. We can document the environment. We can alter it slightly to our advantage and not walk around with the lights off to our disadvantage of losing our best sense, which is sight. So we can allow the environment to work against us, but we can control it to a certain extent, not greatly, but at least we understand it. We have tools and technology that can pick up what's going on in the environment real time. So we have a decent control over the environment. So client plus environment equals ghost. The ghost is the one thing that we have no understanding of. We don't know really what factors it takes to measure a ghost. We assume that we do through EMF detectors and EVP and all these other things, but we really have no idea. We really don't. Science doesn't. We don't. But yet that's the focus of ghost groups. They focused on finding a ghost and ignore the two things that we understand, the client and the environment. So that's essentially the basis for the E4 method. And there's a lot of things that go into this methodology, but that's essentially the gist of it. And E4, if you're wondering, it means something. It stands for something. Eliminate, establish, and list, and engage. Eliminate the subjective and assumption-based investigation. Establish some scientific controls. And the way we do that is focusing on specific events and specific research. Because if I ask you, well, what are signs of a ghost? There's literally 20 or 30 things you could name, from knocks to footsteps to cold air, temperature changes, a visual apparition, objects moving. I mean, we could go on and on and on and on. But when you're doing field work, you should be looking for specific things that have happened specifically to a person or in a location instead of all this other stuff that's really taking away. We jump to conclusions because anything that happens in a haunted environment is automatically a ghost, whether we can back that up or not. Third part, enlist. Enlist isn't joining the army, although I would recommend that as well. If you're 18 years old, do it. Get in. Join the army. Well, you have to anyway, Selective Service. But that's enlisting the client, the person who is having things happen to them currently and is affected by the environment. They're already in tune. They're already a part of the landscape. It's already happening for you. They're doing your job. If you're a ghost investigator, they're already there. Why push them out of the way and have your subjective experience to, quote, verify, unquote, their claims? You're not going to verify it as a ghost. It's impossible. Use the client to view what's going on. Use them to your advantage. And actually using them, you can help them empower themselves and look for logical explanations all at the same time. It's very empowering to put a client up there in charge of the investigation. And last but not least, engage. I just mentioned this. Engage the environment, not ghosts. That's the E4 part of the E4 method. The E4 method is a simple three-phase type of thing. The hardest part is the last part, which is actually using the E4 method, where we're setting up some experiments that attempt to find a repeatable, spontaneous action. So something spontaneous happens around a specific event that we're looking at, and through documentation, we're able to hopefully repeat that experiment. It's a lot to cover in just 8 minutes. And again, I highly recommend getting this book, not just because I wrote it, because I think it's a pretty good idea. And it's a start. It's not the end-all, be-all methodology that's going to change the world. The E4 Method, Breaking the Mold, a Paranormal Investigation by Brian D. Parsons, the book of the week this week. And with that, I can hear the trumpets playing. I can hear the whatever that song is for the presidential march. I can hear that in the background. It's coming. Stay tuned for Frank Lee. Big thanks to Cindy, my producer, and to Dita in the chat room for all her work. As irritating as she can be. Just kidding. We all love you. And everyone else tuning in live or otherwise, well, hopefully you're alive. Keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, and the hair standing on the back of your neck. And always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, you know it. Don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.
You are listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.